Session number 10640.
Major Jack, Creel 2.
But it was clear that everything from the first interview had been well registered in Churchill's brain. And he ended up the discussion with Bailey by saying, "I regret to say that over Yugoslavia I've been seriously misinformed," which is interesting. And this was confirmed by Hudson, who also had a meeting at Chequers with Churchill. And apparently Churchill said to Hudson that he knew Cairo had cooked the books, destroyed records, and that the SOE office in Cairo was a nest of intrigue. Well, that's going a bit far forward, but I just thought I'd mention that as we were passing what happened to that 92-part signal. Now, I just mention another thing, that the Foreign Office minute in November, the question of throwing over Mihailovich is now under consideration. And one must assume that the Foreign Office was completely ignorant of Chetnik operations, of which some 70 were reported to Cairo by BLOs between August and December. Some 70, at the very time that the Foreign Office were considering overthrowing him. And the majority of these incidents were witnessed by British officers, particularly those of major importance, and would also have been operations which the BLOs would have had no personal knowledge of, which weren't reported. And the difference was that as far as the partisans were concerned, they carried out operations generally without British officers there, and then told the British officers what they'd done, and they, or said they'd done, and these are reported back second hand. But as far as we were concerned, we were there with these people most of the time, so we could vouch for what happened. 28th of November, the Tehran conference, Churchill, Roosevelt and Stalin agreed to give maximum help to the partisans. And I remember so well the intelligence officer at Mihailovich's headquarters saying to me a day or two later, "Have you heard about the Tehran conference?" And I hadn't. And he said, "Well, you appear to have given us away." He said, "I can't understand that." And he wasn't angry. He said, "I can't understand that. But do you think you could find out for us what you managed to get in exchange, because it must be very important?" Now, I thought that was a very sensitive expression of his part. He could have been a very angry man, but that's the way he put it, and it was, I thought it was very well put, and I was very touched. Now, Churchill was going to come to Cairo, and they managed to get Maclean and Deakin out to meet him, as we did. No attempt whatsoever was made by SOE to extract representatives from the Mihailovich mission for this meeting with Churchill. Absolutely not. Although Sir Orm Sargent, in a signal to SOE, which is on the records, proposed it and said, "You must get someone out from the Mihailovich mission to give the whole story." SOE made certain that didn't happen. So when Churchill came and met Deakin and Maclean in Cairo on the 9th, 10th of December, they just told him exactly what Tito had told them, and they handed over to him as the gospel, and he swallowed it, looks, you know, hook, sign, line and sinker. And now, early December, without consulting or even informing in advance our mission, SOE signals all the BLOs with the Royalists to sound out their local Chetnik commanders to whether Mihailovich could be replaced as their leader. Well, I think the majority of them refused to do that, but you can imagine the effect that would have had on the Mihailovich mission headquarters, knowing that all these British officers saying, "Okay, let's get rid of the leader, can't you think of someone else," and so on. And then on the 9th of December, SOE sends Armstrong an ultimatum to Mihailovich, and that's the one I was talking about, that he is to blow up certain railway bridges by the 29th of December, failing which he would be completely abandoned. Mihailovich was unable or unwilling to see Armstrong at the time. I think he was away. I think he was going round his corpses. Anyway, so the ultimatum was not delivered until the 23rd of December. And Mihailovich replied that he couldn't undertake the operation until the first half of January, and that he required for the purpose certain arms and ammunition. To this request, SOE said that he had what was required already. And I've already told you that as far as the drops were concerned, we'd had practically nothing, and that no more would be supplied for these operations. And SOE Cairo then, after we'd got there and decided we could do the job ourselves, then forbid us to carry out any more sabotage whatsoever. anywhere in Serbia, because they wanted to make certain that this ultimatum would sink Mihailović. There's no doubt about that, because it's in the files. And then, meanwhile, in 16 days before the original ultimatum had run out, SOE signals all BLOs with the Royalist forces, again without informing or consulting Armstrong, that Mihailović was possibly being dropped, and that all British personnel were to escape to the partisans at once. Which would have meant a long haul across territory which was being fought over. It was no easy matter. Anyway, the only people who did it was Wade and Hudson. The others decided to stay. So that's what's happening in the field. Bailey and Hudson get back to Bari in April, and then they go back to London. And Hudson is so furious, he looked at some of the files, at the distortion shown in the editing of all his signals from the field. He was absolutely furious. He tore some of them up, I think. Sites and Mansfield, the two Americans regain Bari, and then they go straight off to the United States, and they both wrote excellent reports, because they had been all over the country in a way that no British had been. They determined to see what was happening. They walked hundreds and hundreds of miles, and the Mansfield report is really worth seeing. And they convinced Donovan, you know who Donovan was in America.
Can we explain that on the tape?
He was the head of the equivalent of SOE. Donovan was convinced of the truth about Mihailović, and Donovan, with Roosevelt's approval, organizes a USA mission to Mihailović of 40 men divided into six teams. Now, these teams were all briefed, and they were sent off to Italy, and they stood by in a villa near Brindisi. But on the 6th of April, Churchill persuades Roosevelt, in the name of Allied unity, not to send in this mission, and the idea is abandoned. On the 16th of April, Orthodox Easter Sunday, Allied bombers most stupidly bomb Belgrade, causing many casualties amongst the churchgoers. And I saw photographs of that, and the Chetnik said, really, did you have to bomb it? As people were coming out of Mass on Easter Sunday, what a date to choose.
This was Easter 44.
Yeah. May, Bailey and Hudson meet Churchill at Chequers. We have done that already. And then our evacuation, the British liaison officers with the Royalists had been told to concentrate at a place called Pranjane, which is near Čačak. And there, Eric Greenwood and I made a sort of landing ground on top of a flat mountain. And we started the evacuation. The length that you want for a landing ground for a Dakota is 1,400 yards at ground level, and you add 10% for every 1,000 feet above sea level. I suppose we were there about 2,000 feet, so we ought to have added 20% onto 1,400, you'll see, which makes it about 1,700. And this landing ground was about 600. Anyway, we paced it out, and we sent a signal back to SOE saying it was 700 because we thought we would encourage them to land. And so that's what happened. And we were, the first night, the plane came in, and Eric and I were in charge, and it landed beautifully. They dropped some these goosenecked flares, which we put at 100-yard intervals down the runway, but I put them at 90 yards intervals in order to get the measurements right from the air. And the plane landed absolutely on the flare and put the brakes right on, and then just came to a halt before it got to the end. Otherwise, it had gone over the edge. It wasn't a vertical edge, but the mountain went down like that. Turned around and went back and then took off the normal load. And I was, at the far end to see what happened. And I was horrified to find, as the plane came to the end, that the tail wheels were still on the ground. Normally the tail wheels come off. And so the plane ran right off the edge of the mountain and fell about 100 feet in the air, and I was looking down on top of it. Of course, it was in the middle of the night. And the plane did what it shouldn't do, really, to put its searchlight on, because we had another mountain in front of us, or a hill, really. We'd had one or two little farms on top and some orchards, plum orchards. And I thought it was going to hit it. They'd put the headlight on because we'd warned them this feature was in front. And the plane almost stalled, went like that, and just cleared the top, and then turned off from Cairo like that.
What was the date of this, approximately?
30th of May. And the next plane landed, and the pilot said, look, we've there's been a slight problem with the first plane, he told me, and he only just cleared the trees on that far mountainside, so I'm not taking the same load, we're taking a lighter load, which was quite sensible. So he took a lighter load and he managed to get off. Well, when that first plane got back, they found that the undercarriage of the plane had gone through a plum tree on the far mountain. And as a result of that, they couldn't draw the undercarriage up. So they flew across the Adriatic with the undercarriage down all the way to Mare. So the commander of Balkan Air Force said he wasn't risking any more British planes. So we were abandoned. And then the American Air Force stepped in and said they were jolly well going to do it because we had some American airmen with us. And the Americans said, well, if you're going to abandon the British, that's up to you, but we're certainly going to rescue the Americans. We'll take out the British too. And so after a few days, the Americans came in, two planes a night, as far as I remember, in Dakotas, and did the same thing. But it was strange that the British Air Force abandoned us. I've never had a proper explanation about that. And when we got back to Bari, I think I told you, but not on tape, that Jasper and I were sharing a room in the hotel Jasper Rutum, and we went into the SOE office, the Yugoslav office, and there was this huge war map. Should I tell you about it?
In detail, please.
And the areas said to be held by Tito all covered in red flags, and the areas held by Mihailovich were comparatively small on the map, were marked with flags of a different colour, which I can't remember. Anyway, we said to them, this is absolute nonsense. Areas that we know well here, and we've walked over in past months and slept in all these little villages here and there, there isn't a sign of the partisans ever having been anywhere near it. It's a complete royalist Serbian fortress. and the chap in charge of the map said, well, I'm sorry, but these are the facts. And of course, this is what was the stuff coming out from Tito's headquarters, in which Tito was saying, we've got this, we've got that, we've got that, we've got that, but none of it verified by British officers. Anyway, having argued about it, Jasper Rutum, who was a man who was usually retained his sang-froid, as I think I told you, he'd been private secretary to Neville Chamberlain in Number 10, and very intelligent person indeed, he lost his temper and went up to the wall map and swept all the pins onto the ground, not all of them, but a good many of them, to express his indignation, the whole thing. We were then seen by Stowell, General Stowell, who was then commanding the SOE in Bari. And this is quoted from in David Martin's book. I can't remember what he said, but he's quoted in quotes as saying, you chaps have become mentally contaminated, speaking to us in the Mihailovich missions. The chaps you have been with aren't really on our side at all. The only people who are the partisans, unquote.
This is Martin's book, Petrus Otre.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Well, none of us were allowed into the SOE offices again. That was the end of that. But I pressed Klugman, who I think I told you I'd known at my prep school, who was G2 intelligence in the Yugoslav office, to come to the bedroom that Jasper and I were sharing. And we gathered round us six or so, about half a dozen of our friends, and we asked him to explain this extraordinary situation in which we'd been put in Yugoslavia. And the lamentable lack of supply and support, the pure appalling delays in signal system, the gross inefficiency in general. And Klugman apologizes with lame excuses that policy changes were decided at a much higher level and inefficiency is due to overworked personnel. But it was terribly unconvincing. Terribly unconvincing, but nevertheless, what else could we believe? Couldn't possibly believe that there were Soviet moles working in the office, or even those who were very strongly communist-orientated, although they weren't Soviet moles. But still, there we were.
Had Klugman at any time made his communist views clear to you?
No. Of course, I only knew him when we were age 12, you see. So, of course, there's not the sort of time when you have communist views. And when I met him in Cairo before going in, it was only just to say, how are you, and tell me what you've been doing, that sort of thing, but I had absolutely no idea of his communist leanings at all.
Because it appears he made no secret of the fact that he was a communist.
To those who were working with him in the SOE office, there was absolutely not the slightest doubt. In the same way, there was absolutely no doubt at all about Basil Davidson's concepts of things. I mean, he was extremely left-wing. In fact, he used to refer to him and Klugman and others in the offices as "we partisans."
That was before he went in.
Now, numerous reports in June, talking about the SOE office in Cairo, there were several left-wingers in it apart from Klugman. The MI6 office considered so insecure by Lyle of the PWE that he refused to circulate classified documents to it. Refused to circulate classified documents to MI6. Arnoldi, the head of the OSS, Secret Intelligence, Yugoslav section, actually employed partisan women in partisan uniform in key positions in his office in Bahrain. Now, in June, July, we, of course, came back to England, numerous reports from Mihailovich that more US air crew were ready for evacuation, and the 15th US Air Force was in favour of rescuing them, but SOE was against. They didn't want any more contact, Allied contact with Mihailovich. 15th American Air Force proposed sending their own mission, SOE wouldn't even allow that. So eventually President Roosevelt insists on Churchill allowing this to happen. And finally, a mission was sent in, and Muslin, who'd been with us, one of the American subalterns, he was sent in to start this. And it's the most curious situation. Taking off from the airfield at Bari, there were 7 aborted takeoffs for Muslin. 7! For various reasons. There must be a story behind that.
You don't think it was just coincidence?
7? No. SOE claimed that Pragnani, which is the area where we made this sort of little airfield, was now in partisan hands, and as usual, when our friend got there, the American, he found it was still in Mihailovich's hands. And then in August, Colonel McDowell joins Mihailovich, the American, and the map in the SOE office, he said when he arrived in, he saw the same map that we saw. When he got into Yugoslavia, he found that it was completely false, as it had been when we saw it. And McDowell was a Serbian expert. He'd spent the whole of the period between the First and Second War in the Balkans. So he knew more about the Balkans than any other American could possibly have done. And have you read the McDowell report?
No.
No, well, he came out later. But he was there with Muslin and with Lulich and one or two other Americans to get out all these American airmen, you'll see, which there were then an enormous number. They got out, I think, 430, which had been brought in by Mihailovich's forces from all over Serbia. They dropped like confetti coming back from raids mostly on the Ploiești oil mines in oil fields in Romania. There's no record that I know of there ever being handed over to the Germans or anything, because there were, of course, awards for the handing over of these American arms to the Germans. But this huge area of Serbia, which was so strongly pro-Mihailovich and pro-royalist, they succeeded in getting all these airmen from all over the place, putting them up for days and days and days, feeding them, lodging them, getting boots for them, that sort of thing, although they hadn't got enough for themselves. And eventually, thanks to the protection given to Mihailovich around the Pragnani area, they were all evacuated. 435 American air crew were evacuated from Pragnani in that period, and we took out about 30, so we're getting up to 500 American airmen rescued in total by Mihailovich. On 22nd of August, Hitler still displays hostility to Mihailovich and says to Field Marshal von Weichs, who was the Commander-in-Chief of Southeastern Europe, quote, "Naturally, the armament of Chetniks is out of the question," because there had been a suggestion, because the BBC is saying the Chetniks were, you know, ready to help and that sort of thing, that they could help fight the partisans and the Russians who were coming in. And General Jodl, summing up Hitler's attitude, says, quote, "A Serbian army must not be allowed to exist. It is better to have some danger from the communists." And then on the 7th of September, Mihailovich calls for the Ustanak, the uprising, which SOE had never credited him with the will to do. McDowell and other USA personnel witnessed the whole thing. Thousands presented themselves at recruiting centers, but weapons only for 40,000, virtually none supplied by the Allies. Just previously, the Germans' estimation of Mihailovich's strength was 60,000 to 70,000. And then many from the Home Guard, the Nedichevs, I told you, joined Mihailovich at that time. partisans attack fiercely. And consequently, because of the partisans attacking the Serbs and the loyalists fiercely, the Germans evacuated their troops from Greece with surprising ease. Thus a major opportunity was lost. Now, this area, you see, was the area which I was interested in, the Morava and the Ibar Valley. Those two railway lines are the bridges which I reconnoitred. If they'd been blown up, that was the very time they should have been, you see, when the evacuation from Greece was taking place. Soviet troops reached the Yugoslav front on the 6th of September. Mihailovich proposes to the Russians a plan for the royalists and partisans to be confined to their respective territories until Yugoslav is completely liberated. The Russians reject the proposal. Tito levants to Moscow without telling McLean he's going, and he tells Stalin that in the event of a British invasion of Yugoslavia, quote, we should offer strenuous resistance. That's on record. Muslin returns to Italy on the 9th September, and Mihailovich withdraws under partisan attacks into Bosnia. 9th of October, Churchill meets Stalin in Moscow. They split up Eastern Europe nations into spheres of influence, East and West. As far as I remember, Greece was 10% Russian, 90% British, or Western, and Yugoslavia was 50-50. I've often wondered what that meant, because although Stalin agreed to 50-50, of course he became completely 100% communist. Lalic returns to Italy with more American aircrew and offers to evacuate Mihailovich with him, because he's the last, pretty well the last chap to come, and he is the last chap to come out, but Mihailovich refuses. Now, the right-wing leader of the Albanian resistance came out to Italy. He wasn't going to stay behind, have his throat cut or to be shot. But Mihailovich had the courage and the conviction. He knew then what his end was going to be, but he was not going to abandon his people or the loyal troops who'd been with him all through this difficult time. So he refused to be evacuated. March 45, 30,000 Chetniks remain. End of May, only 2,000 Chetniks left. And from then they melt away. Some of them join the partisans. When the partisans capture Chetniks, they say, will you join us? And if you don't, we shoot you. So a lot of Chetniks did join the partisans in order to fight against the Germans. I think I'd probably have done the same thing. On the 24th of March, 46, Yugoslav announcement that Mihailovich was captured 10 days before. On the 10th of June, the trial of Mihailovich and others start. And we can talk about that later because I've got details of it. On the 15th of July, Emvich and 10 others condemned to death. And then on the 17th of July, Mihailovich is shot. So I think that gives you a synopsis of the thing.
Now, this material from which you've used to give your account, can you say something about the documentary sources from which you've obtained the material for this?
Yes. Shall I read them out to you?
Yes.
David Martin's Patriot or Traitor, Basil Davidson's Special Operations Europe, Stefan Pavlovich Yugoslavia, which is a first-class book of the history of Yugoslavia in the World series, Fitzroy MacLean's Eastern Approaches, Chapman Pincher's Their Trade is Treachery, Deakin's The Embattled Mountain, and Jasper Rutum's Misfire, and finally Nora Beloff's Tito's Flawed Legacy.
Now, you were talking about reprisals, the German reprisals
Yes.
that were taken. What was the effect of these reprisals on the activity of the various Yugoslav guerrilla forces?
As far as the communists were concerned, the partisans were concerned, they actually encouraged reprisals. Because their force was a force of people who run away into the mountains. And the more reprisals there were, the more fugitives would rush into the mountains. And so that is the answer to that one.
And on the Chetniks?
And on the Chetnik side, on the royalist side, it was quite different. The royalist forces were based on areas. And they came from the various villages round about and the towns round about, and they knew what was going in their villages and so on. And so the reprisals meant a lot to them because It was their own, not necessarily relations or even friends, but people from their own locality who were being taken out and shot. And what one's got to remember is that the Germans arrested a huge number of Serbs and sort of stored them in prisons so that they could just be taken out and shot from the prisons. They didn't have to go out in the countryside and arrest them. They were already in the prisons. And they would take out people who came from that area. And then they would publish a huge sign which would be displayed, which would say that these people have all been taken out and shot, and they come from. I've got one here which I'll show you later, if you like, which has all the details on it. The Germans had issued an order, Hitler had, on 16 September 41, that for every German killed, 100 hostages would be shot, and for every German wounded, 50. And one of the most tragic examples of that was in the early period, before I was there, of course, in mid-October 41, in a sortie near Kragujevac, which is a town south of Belgrade, 10 Germans were killed and 26 wounded. And as a result, on the 21st of October, 7,000 hostages were taken out from the town and shot, including hundreds of schoolboys. That's the incident at Kragujevac, but it may be a rather exceptional one. But nevertheless, I think it gives us some indication of what it was. And as far as total losses are concerned, the Ustasche murdered, it's very difficult to know how many. I mean, even the Yugoslavs themselves say that they think the Ustasche, who were Croats and many of them were Muslims, murdered in the early days of the Civil War 500,000 Serbs in Croatia. There were 2 million Serbs who would emigrate.